Hello, this is the podcast for our class number 18 on Wednesday, October 27. And in this class, we continue to talk about proximate cause. Proximate cause is, you know, of course, is just a limitation upon liability. We've seen other limitations, duty, breach not a limitation, breach is just a question of fact, cause in fact, not a limitation. And now we come to the final element, and the rationale behind this element is that there is a feeling as a policy that some accidents are just too remote, too far away, not so much in time and space, but in result from the original negligence, that our negligent actor should not be responsible for all of the injuries that resulted, even though they certainly are cause and fact. It's a but-for cause. The rules of proximate cause then have been developed to basically provide a limit and a rationale for the courts and juries to understand where that limitation is. So think about the policies behind it. Think about the type of harm that resulted. And know that you first have to make sure that you're identifying what the negligent act is. If you see some freaky facts or some very strange accident with a strange injury, don't immediately start talking about proximate cause. You have to identify the negligence, and you have to identify that it was the cause in fact. You can't talk about proximate cause unless you identify the negligent action, because even under any of the rules that we've talked about, you must have clearly identified what the negligent act is before you can see whether it either was the Polemus rule, the direct consequence of that negligent act, or the Wagenmund rule, the foreseeable result of that negligent act. So, don't jump in at the end. Go through your elements and clearly identify your negligent action. Again, we said when the original negligence involves an impact upon the person of our plaintiff, courts are very willing to overlook some very unforeseeable results. So that's why our rule of the eggshell skull plaintiff comes in. That's why our rules regarding aggravation of the original injury. These rules are very policy oriented, and certainly can, under certain circumstances, take the question away from the jury or just be another question for the juries to look at what the facts are. So again, always identify your negligence, and then identify what was so unusual about the end result. What was unusual about the end result? So we saw, again, with Ben V. Thomas, it was an unusual extent of the injury, maybe type, there's no magic in putting these categories on, but it does help you understand how they should be analyzed. When we talk about unusual type, and I always use unexpected just because I don't want to use the word foreseeable unless we're talking about it in its strict legal sense. So I'm using unexpected. It means the same thing, but foreseeability has some very specific legal meanings, and I don't really want to, I don't want to mess you up with using, tossing the term around indiscriminately. So an unexpected type of injury, you drop a plank and all of a sudden the ship burns down. Now that certainly is unexpected. That's polemus. You drop some oil and you drop some oil on water and suddenly the dock burns down. Maybe not so unforeseeable, but we saw in Wagon Mound our plaintiff could not claim that a burning dock is an unforeseeable result of dropped motor oil, because then they, since they had a big hand in it, they would have been out of a lawsuit. So they had to want to say, oh, polemus should apply. Wagon Mound, they adopted a new rule for unexpected type of injury. You should know both of these. They're both in use. Foreseeability is, you know, I think I would say the more commonly used way to limit liability under proximate cause, but direct consequences always pops up in places. So it would not, it's not that difficult for you to analyze it using both, because you want to see whether they come up with different results. So again, Wagon Mound has our foreseeability test. Who determines foreseeability? Well, it's just like reasonable care. It's another question of fact for the jury, but the judge has to really decide whether there are enough facts to get you to the jury. When we're dealing with proximate cause, judges are much more willing, since there's so much more of a policy implication to it, are much more willing to get involved and decide as a matter of law that something can't be foreseeable. So we'll see that when we see that when we talked about Doe. But again, all of these tests, polemus, Wagon Mound, all of these tests are used to discover, determine, evaluate whether the ultimate injury fell within the scope of the risk created by the negligent behavior. So the idea of the risk, what is that negligent behavior? What was the negligent behavior, and what was the risk created by that negligent behavior? So the Darcy case that we looked at, it has to be etched in your memory forever. The landowner who didn't warn his guests about swimming in the rat urined pond. Guests went and swam and they drowned. They didn't die from the disease in the pond, and that's what made his that was what made him negligent, was that he didn't warn about the disease. They died, but it wasn't from the disease, so no proximate cause, no liability for that. Distinguish between Venticelli, the case that had the broken lock on the car's luggage compartment, and the fact that the risk created by having a broken lock was not what ultimately resulted, so that it was outside the scope of the risk. As opposed to Derridian, the case that I said, it was just mentioned in the book, but case had the construction company and had negligently built a safety barrier on a construction site. A driver then forgot to take his medication, passed out, drove through the barrier and hit a construction worker. In spite of the fact that there was an intervening negligent act, the ultimate injury was one that you was within the scope of the risk was exactly the risk that was created by the original negligence. So these two cases, they talk about whether intervening factors will break the causal chain, and look to see always at the what was the foreseeable result, the scope of the risk created by the individual injury, the initial injury. And then we talked about Doe v. Mannheimer. And this is a difficult case. It's a case that is a lot of nuance. I maintain that this case would be decided very, very differently in New York, and perhaps at the initial question of duty to the plaintiff. And we'll see that again in Paul's graph. But here in Doe v. Mannheimer, duty was not a question. Why wasn't it a question? Because it was an injury, a criminal activity on the property, and it was foreseeable. There was lots of criminal activity in that area. So duty wasn't questioned at all. Breach was not questioned, but for the overgrown bushes, court decided the rape wouldn't have occurred. And the question, though, is the proximate cause. Did the criminal activity break the causal chain created by the overgrown bushes? How do you judge that? Was it unforeseeable or foreseeable? The intervening criminal activity, the intervening action, did it supersede the original negligence? That's all our question is about. Did the intervening action, that is the criminal activity, supersede the original negligence? When does it supersede original negligence? When it's unforeseeable. So that's why we have the question, was the rape foreseeable or unforeseeable? And the court decided it was unforeseeable, even though criminal activity was foreseeable. That's why there was a duty. Rape was not. All that was foreseeable was drunkenness, drug use, a bunch of louts hanging around in the area behind the bushes, but not the rape. There had been one other rape, but it had been indoors. So the court said rape here was unforeseeable, therefore the intervening act, the intervening criminal act under the restatement, the intervening criminal act was unforeseeable and broke the causal chain. Note that it's a complicated case. When we talk about Paul's graph, we'll have a question. We'll be able to again look at the notion of foreseeability. And I maintain that New York would have treated this differently. But the thing to look at in this case, I mean, it was interesting. They had this environmental psychologist who testified that something like a rape should have been foreseeable because of the negligence. The negligence precipitated it. It was a catalyst to the rape, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't believe, the court obviously didn't believe this environmental psychologist, although the jury did. If you look at this, the jury had decided liability and gave $500,000 to the plaintiff. This is an instance where the court, and you see it in proximate cause cases because policy is so important, the court says no reasonable jury could have decided that this was foreseeable. As a matter of law, it's not foreseeable. Interesting way how the court intervenes. They wouldn't do this. They would. You wonder whether they would do this in other questions of fact. So that's why I always say proximate clause is hybrid. There's so much law and policy to it, but it can, at the end of the day, be sent to the jury. if the judge decides there's no reason to limit it as a matter of law and we're just looking at questions of foreseeability, a jury can easily decide that. So again, these characterizations are important when we're trying to figure out what rule to apply. Is it, does it involve an impact upon the person? So, but that just went so far beyond what you would expect. Courts very, very likely to look the other way and say, oh, well, there's nothing, you know, it's still within the scope of the risk because we have rules that deal with that. Is there aggravation in a sense of something came along, some negligence came along and made it worse? Again, when it's an impact upon a person, we have rules to deal with that. Is it such an unexpected type of injury? You expected damage to the ship and actually it burned down. Polemus or wagon man, look to direct consequences or foreseeability. How do we stop it? By an intervening negligence that supersedes the original negligence. When is the intervening negligence supersede? When it's unforeseeable. When is intervening criminal activity foreseeable or unforeseeable? Let's see whether the court wants to look at how specific. Generally, it says it has to be of the general type of general type of foreseeability. But we see in Doe v. Mannheimer, they got very specific. Okay, so next class we're going to go to Paul's graph. Most famous case, read it, enjoy it. It's like a little soap opera. Then we'll do the Kinsman cases at the end, Kinsman 1 and 2, and then we'll go spend some time talking about, at least introducing the notion of affirmative defenses, although affirmative defenses, the conduct of the plaintiff will not be included on the midterm. We're going to talk about it a little bit at the end of next class.